Hey, it's Doug here, and I just wanted to pop in before I send it to the episode. Some exciting news, at least for this episode, is that Carl joined me to do the interview. So it was pretty fun. It actually ended up being just before the book launch party at the Mr. Money Mustache HQ. So it was kind of a full day. We all hung out for a few hours together, and it was a fun party. But it's good to have Carl back in the studio. And hopefully we'll be able to get him in at least once a quarter or so to have a fun discussion and hang out. The sound check is pretty interesting and hopefully a little bit surprising just because of the topic area. So do hang around for that. Also want to let you know, if you want to help out the show, I'm an affiliate for Mint Mobile, and that's why I've been doing some ads here and there. The thing is, I'm a Mint Mobile user, so I save about $1,080 per year because I switched over to Mint. I used to be on one of the big companies, but I tested out Mint, and it was absolutely fine. I had no issues with service or anything like that. So I pay about $15 per month, and my wife pays about the same. And if you pay in, you know, a big chunk, like annually, then that's when you really lock in that savings. So before, we were paying about $1,440 per year, but now it's much, much less. And basically, $180 each for us, so 360 total, hence all the savings. So if you do want to help support the show, check out Mint Mobile if you're not on a discount carrier already. You can go to milehighfi.com/mint, and this is kind of a special offer, so you can test them out for a few months, but it's only going on for a couple days here. You can actually buy 2 months and get one free on the 5 gig plan. So they have various plans that you could select, and I don't want to make it too confusing, but if you use the coupon code free month, you can get that 5 gig plan. And I think a lot of people, 5 gigs is totally enough, but if you know you use more data than that, maybe you travel a lot for some reason, you use a lot more data, maybe the 5 gig plan isn't quite right. But anyway, the code is free month, and that is valid until January 2nd, 2025. So only a couple days left for that. But either way, usually you can get the $15 per month plan, just like Elizabeth and I have. Without further ado, let's send it to the show.
Hello, world. Welcome to the Mile High Fi podcast. I'm your host, Carl Jensen, with my co-host.
I'm Doug Cunnington.
Doug, I'm going to read a little excerpt from the jacket of this book. Life is a game that is your opportunity to learn how to play it. Start Thinking Rich earns a well-deserved spot on the bookshelves of all individuals seeking a blueprint to wipe the cobwebs from their eyes, realize the countless possibilities in front of them, and achieve their loftiest financial goals. Who do we have with us today?
What's up, everybody? It's Adrian Brambilla here. I used to dance for T-Pain. I got famous on the internet for living in a van while showing how I was making 6 figures a month. And I don't live in a van anymore. I live in Austin, Texas, and co-author of Start Thinking Rich, my very first book. But I'm a content creator, and have been since 2010. I'll always be creating content online.
I am Dr. Brad Klontz. I am a clinical psychologist, but my specialty is the psychology of money and wealth. I'm also a professor where I teach financial psychology at Creighton University. I also own an asset management company, but I'm probably best known for being a TikTok superstar.
So y'all have done something like 50 interviews about the book, and we don't want to hit all the same topics. I listened to several of them. They're awesome. So people could definitely check those out. So I want to have like a roundtable type discussion. Feel free to jump in. And obviously the book is focused about helping people get rich and think rich. And our audience consists of people who are more on the advanced side of FI and FIRE. So they're already thinking rich or well on their way. It turns out that as people in the FIRE movement, we have built strong habits about saving and being frugal. And if we can do something, we find it virtuous to do it ourselves, even when we should hire someone to do it. The DIY mindset. Are you guys free of this?
Ooh. So in our book, we call it do-it-yourself-itis. It's an inflammation. And, you know, I grew up lower income, and that's what you had to do. Like, it's a great wealth building strategy. It's like, don't outsource it, do it yourself. And if you grew up in a low income environment or on a farm, like my dad did, that's what everyone does. Everyone chips in, you do it yourself. However, I've seen it be a barrier in my own life too, by the way, that keeps people sort of middle class and stuck because we have difficulty outsourcing. And, you know, one of the chapters of our book, we talk about only poor people are afraid to ask for help. And that's really based on some research we've done looking at ultra wealthy individuals who are much more likely to admit they don't know something and to say, hey, look, I'm not going to spend the next 1,000 hours learning how to be a dentist and pull my own tooth out. I'm going to go outsource that to somebody who can do it more efficiently. And so they're more likely to have CPAs and financial advisors and a whole host of things. And it really does become a wealth building strategy to outsource some of that expertise, because even a few hundred bucks paying for a CPA can save you thousands. And so eventually it becomes something that helps you, you know, become wealthier along the way, but can really limit your growth and potential.
So don't live in a van anymore. I moved to Austin. Parents came for the first time to check out the house. My dad's like, I am going to get you a gift. And he comes back with a weed whacker. And I started laughing. I was like, what the fuck is this? He's like, I'm not going to do my yard work. Like, and in fact, my dad got angry at me and he needed like a cooling off period that he raised some son that's too good to do yard work. But my parents are Mexican. I'm Mexican. It's like, as a Mexican in a household, like, you do so much yard work as a kid. So like, when I became financially free, I was like, I am not going to do yard work. And I also was so good at optimizing my business. When I was living in the van, I only had Wi-Fi one day a week. And so when I moved in the house, my business was still that streamlined. And what was I doing with my freedom of time? I was doing my own laundry. I was doing my own dishes. I was doing like yard work and stuff. So I was like, what? I didn't achieve financial freedom to do chores. So I hired someone to do my yard. I have a house admin. This person, I pay him $25 an hour. She does anything that's related to house. Here's a quick example. My dad also gave me a bunch of shit for this. I bought a Hasty Bake charcoal grill, and it's a really awesome, awesome grill. Recommend it. And it came in. I opened up the manual. I was like, oh my God, this is going to take 5 hours and I'm not handy at all. So I literally handed it to my house admin, and then I took a trip to do a podcast interview, and I came back, it was done. And she's like, it took 4 hours. So like, she does just general assistant work. We've been traveling a lot this year, but we've been gone pretty much this whole year. Before that, I even went as far as I had a chef, personal chef. It was $3,500 a month. This was one that I thought, I'm Mexican. I love food. I love cooking. I could never outsource cooking. But it turns out, you know what I like more than cooking? Eating. So I had the chef, and I'm always like obsessively trying to look for ways to outsource my time. And I think it's because I just saw my parents do everything. And then as a kid, you like, I had to earn my keep. I was also doing yard work and wheelbarrows and stuff. So now I almost like, as a habit, like try to outsource. Sometimes I think in like movies, rich people, they don't even drive their own car. They have a driver to save them time. It's crazy.
Was it hard to outsource stuff that you know you could do? Because this is my struggle. Like a couple years ago, our net worth was multiple millions at that time. It was like 20 degrees outside. I hate working on cars, but the front brakes on the car went out. So I'm in my garage with a blowtorch, like hammering on the car, like tons of profanity. I think my kids learned how to swear that day. And now I think back, like, why the hell did you do that, dummy? You should have just taken it to some like brake person. But I find it, right, I'm getting better, but I found it very difficult to outsource stuff or not do stuff that I could do. Did you struggle with that at all, or is it? And if not, tell me your secrets.
I think it was just the way, you know, like sometimes when you watch your parents do something, you do it, and then also sometimes you watch your parents do something like I resent this. So I had this like this idea of like me doing manual labor. I'm the first Brambilla to graduate from a 4-year university, so it was like that was a whole reason. It's like, so we don't have to do manual labor like to. Think and make money and work, make money based off of your mind versus your hands. And so like, I don't know. It's just like, I resented the idea of like doing this manual labor. So I didn't struggle with that. I looked for opportunities, but I do think, you know, I always have to reference, it sounds like I live a very lavish life. I'm very lavish with time. I'm, if I now today it's almost like, what if this, I will happily spend money to buy back time. Whereas I'm really stingy and conservative with like stuff. So, and it's one funny conversation I have talking to people who are financially free. We all have something that we're really usually lavish on, and then something that doesn't make sense at all, we spend and bicker hours over like pennies. It's like, it wouldn't really, our time is worth so much more than, but we're all, you know, we're all human. We have stuff like that. So time stuff, I didn't struggle with it. I couldn't wait. Once I realized that I had this realization, like, oh my gosh, like I don't actually have to do this stuff. So it was more of like a desire to be unburdened by like normal, like house and chores type of stuff.
Man, that was a great quote. I'm lavish with time. So you're willing to buy stuff that gets you your time back. I think that's a great way to reframe the whole thought.
So a lot of the audience, like I said, we're frugal and we got to where we are. We saved money. How can we feel comfortable to spend more, especially when we have this habit that it's a hurdle, like it's keeping us from doing it. Even though we know we can spend the money, we've prepared to spend the money. We budgeted spending the money, but we're still like not able to flip the switch. So how can we change the mindset? I'll kick it to you, Brad.
Yeah. So in the research we've done on ultra wealthy people, they have a certain mindset and we call it very specifically money vigilance, right? So it's everyone that's listening to this podcast. It's like, oh, it's important to save for a rainy day. You have a clear, exciting vision of the future. I mean, why are you willing to do this? Why are you willing to make sacrifices right now? We're not wired to do that. Most Americans aren't doing that, by the way. You're weird. You're the strange ones doing this. So you have to have that really exciting vision. So we're really good at it, but there's some underlying anxiety associated with it. And the anxiety is actually helpful. Think about a squirrel who's not anxious about the winter. So not out there hustling, not out there, you know, collecting nuts. By the way, real interesting world of squirrels where they hide nuts from each other. If another squirrel's looking, you know, they pretend that they're hiding one. But we're like that. We're these squirrels worried about the winter. And that's why we're doing well in the long term. But quite often, you know, as you said, you can't just flip the switch. It's not like a switch where you're like, oh, great, now I'm rich. And by the way, when you do studies on most rich people, almost none of them describe themselves as rich. Like it's not like they don't even flip that switch. And so I think that it's really important to try to find ways to live it along the way. It can't be this thing like I'm going to have success and then I'm going to be happy and then I'm going to start spending. You have to learn to start spending along the way. It's actually a muscle that has to get exercised and has to be built, especially if you come from that lower income, hustle, anxiety, scarcity mindset. So I think it's a practice. And so I would encourage people to, wherever you're at on your journey, you're going to have to try to build this in. Like money is to be spent and enjoyed also.
Do you guys, I'm imagining you guys know your math on projections or have looked at it like, what is it? If I keep doing what I'm doing now, what's the money in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years? And then like, do you ever play around with like, what if I increased and I invested more, what it would do? Like I imagine we all kind of do this. And I feel like there has to be some point where a level of income doesn't change your lifestyle. And I think that for people that come from the frugal side, spending money is hard. So like, what truly is a difference if when you are 70, there's an extra 30, 20, 10, 5 million? Is there actually going to be a difference in the way you live? Then if you're already at the point where you're in this abundance, then now you should spend money. Like, because there actually is no difference unless there's this new level you want to get to. So like you call it like, do you got billionaire aspirations? Do you want to live a billionaire's life? And then if that's what you want to do, then it does make sense. Like keep investing more. But if you don't have the aspirations to attain what 100 millionaire, 500 millionaire, billionaire, like then it's you got to spend the money now.
One of the things I struggled with is like I've gotten more comfortable with spending, but I'm like, okay, what objects can I buy or what kind of experiences could I buy that would make me happy? And it's difficult because I think when people go to that question, they usually think about the big ticket items like I want this house, maybe a vacation house, or I want to upgrade my current house, or I want this car. I thought about all that stuff and that stuff doesn't really do it. And I think Doug and I have probably came to the same thing, the same realization. I'm looking at your guitars, which aren't that expensive. They're not going to break the bank. How much was your most expensive guitar? Do you care to say?
Maybe $3,000.
Okay. Well, it's more than I would have thought. Doug, you're a big spender. Can I borrow some money, Doug? Some of the things we do is just making travel easier. Like, I have two kids, and we used to get one hotel room, and the kids would be on one queen size bed, and we'd be on the other bed, and the kids would be fighting. Now we're like, fuck that. We're going to give them their own bed, and they can have it out in their own room, and taking flights that aren't at 5 a.m. or it's little things like that. Having the lounge access with a fancy credit card. I don't know. It's not big stuff, but it's something I'm still working on. Do you have any thoughts on spending for happiness or anything around that?
Yeah, I mean, the research shows that material items, I mean, it's great that you didn't find that out the hard way. So most people I know, you know, they get the money and then they get the vacation house. Of course, it's so cool to have this vacation house. And then you catch them on the downside. We're like, I gotta get rid of this freaking vacation house, you know, because it doesn't lead to happiness. And it's this, it's like Adrian likes to say that you don't own your stuff owns you. So now it's this vacation house you're worried about. And then you're like, well, where are we going to go on vacation? Well, we should probably go to the vacation house. I mean, we're paying how much for it? And so people find out the hard way after they've spent all the money that that stuff's not going to give them lasting happiness. Whereas spending money on experiences, on the little things to enhance your day-to-day life, I think that's what really matters in terms of happiness. And also giving and finding things you're passionate about, causes that really matter to you. That's, if you want to know what people who've made it, that's kind of what they're focused on, is like, how do I make an impact? How do I improve the world? How can I, you know, leave a legacy that really matters? And so it's that spending with purpose too. So it's less stuff, it's more experiences and purpose.
I think impact and experience, I think, are always the best ways to spend money. I also feel like I'm curious, like, I don't know if it's for you guys in your family tree, but like, I'm the person who's accumulated the most, definitely by age and in total. And so I don't have someone to call or lean on, or grandpa or uncle, that's like, so what do we do now? So a lot of how I like to operate is like, I'm a very curious person and playful person. So 2 birthdays ago, I was like, I want to go to a fine dining restaurant, the nicest place in Austin. And I want everything. I want the wine pairing. I want the 4-hour tasting menu. On my birthday, that was the first time I spent, it was just my wife and I, and I think the bill came out to like $1,300. That's a ton of money, most money by like 5x, 6x we've ever spent. And at the end of it, I was like, that was amazing. Oh my God. It was so good. Everything had a story. It was amazing. And now we, you know, that's not something that's definitely a norm. I actually haven't spent that much money on dinner, but we've gone back to that restaurant, not for a special occasion, just because like we desired it and we didn't do all the extra caviar. I mean, caviar, would you like caviar? How much is it? $50 for this little like 4 things? Like, but that time I was like, I'm a yes man. I'm going to say yes to it. And it was amazing. So like, again, that was curiosity. And I think like, my dad, I love you, Dad, if you listen to this, like if there's just, I think it's $50. If the plate's over $50, it doesn't matter if it's the best steak he's ever had his life. The answer is, it's too expensive. And I feel like that, I love treating my dad and my parents to nice things, but like, it's like, he's so price oriented on like, if it's past a certain threshold for him, he can't actually enjoy the experience. And I think that is the problem. That's the problem.
Well, that's a cool example too, because like $1,300 is a lot for 2 people, but it's not that much. Like, it was cool to check it out and to see, like, did that make you happy? Was it as good as you thought it was? And Carl, have you done something like that? I'm trying to remember. You had a couple expensive meals, although he's a Taco Bell man overall. But.
We went to a Michelin star rated Mexican restaurant, Frontera Grill in Chicago, which was great.
Okay.
Amazing.
Just great. This sounds underwhelming, man.
No. Well, the thing that I struggle with when I go to these fancy restaurants, like if I ever, like I've never had really, really good food in my life. So when I do, and I went to Oaxaca just to sample moles, like this food is so good that like everything else sucks from that point on. It ups the ante and re-anchors you. And I think it actually, it makes me wealthier because I'm less likely to go out to eat because I know it's going to be a disappointment because I had the Oaxacan mole. And plus, it was like $10 for like one of the best meals of my life. But money wasn't even in the factor. So when I have these really good meals, it's kind of a anchor reset. I appreciate them. I'm not going to do them every day. Yeah.
I think this is something I see with FIRE movement people. You're almost afraid to say the nice thing you had, and you just disguised something that you did that I think is really rich. I went to Oaxaca to try mole.
Yeah.
Right? Some people, it's like, I got PTO, only got 14 days, I got to go somewhere. It's like, no, you went to this place just to seek out something. To me, that's rich life. But like the fire moment, they're like, downplay it. But I save most of my money and I don't spend. It's not a normal thing. It's like, we're always trying to downplay it. It's like, dude, like that you're living rich life. You're doing it. But it's funny, like different rooms, conversations. I appreciate, this is why I love the FIRE movement. I identify for it, identify with it, because like we have the funnest first world problem that we've created. It's like, try to live and be okay with spending money if it makes us happy.
All right. You guys, actually, I'll direct it to you, Adrian, first, but it actually applies to both of you. So you're a little bit ahead of the curve, as far as I understand, with pickleball. And this is a passion for you guys. So I'm going to let you just talk about it a little bit. So when did you get into pickleball? And then talk about the competitive nature that you guys have.
Yeah. My parents started playing 13 years ago. And it was really grassroots then. And they kept inviting me out. I was like, old people, I don't want to play. And then it took 2 years. So I've been playing for 11 years. And back then, pickleball was super grassroots. The funniest thing I remember back then is like, if you wanted to buy a paddle, it was like a drug deal. Like, there was a guy at the pickleball courts. He had a van. And he'd open up the van. He's like, yo, what kind of paddle you want? Like, you want the waffle cone? And he would like make it on the spot. And then you'd pay like $60 for it. Like, that, like back then.
Make it on the spot? He just had like material. It
was like a DIY paddle shop guy, and like he was like the local dealer for all the paddles. Like, and then, there was only one tournament a year. My mom, she was often like one of the top female like senior pros back in the day. But the game has changed so much. Like they have a rating system, a Duper, which is like an algorithm based ranking. I'm 5'6", in case you want to look that up. But
it's very good. Everybody.
So back then a 5'0". Today is like a 4-0. So the game is truly elevated. But I have a court at my house as of like maybe 5 weeks ago. So play every day if I can, if the weather's good and my body's not sore. And it's just a blast. I've met so many incredible people through pickleball. Man, after playing 11 years, I've only met 3 people who were like dicks.
Yeah.
So like, I would say that's, out of anything I've ever done, humble, outgoing, outdoorsy, active people, pickleball people are just such a good way to meet people.
Right on.
Yeah, we actually showered, came over here.
Not together.
We played together. Yeah, no, actually Adrian turned me on to it about, was it maybe a year and a half ago? Something like that. And I played tennis in college. So I'm like, pickleball, give me a break. I'm going to whoop your ass. and he schooled me pretty hard. And ever since then, I'm like, you need purpose and meaning in your life. And my purpose right now is to beat Adrian at pickleball. And I train 10 hours a week. 10 hours a week, baby. And much to my chagrin, he's now training more than that. So it'll.
Oh, yeah.
I'm going to have a real hard time catching up.
You guys play?
A little bit. I'm more in the just past beginner phase. Yeah. And Carl?
I have not yet, but I'm dying to give it a try. I'll play with you, Doug, sometime soon at the rec center, right behind your house.
Yeah. And my wife, she played tennis and was pretty good. I think she was like 4-0-ish. So the transition was good. It's like we've gotten older, like it's easier on her body and she could play more often. Everyone's cool. There's always drama with fucking tennis, right?
There really
I don't
is.
Know if you got into all that mess, right? Yeah. So yeah, she's enjoyed it and met a lot of friends, and there's some nice indoor courts. I was going to say this whole thing's happening because of our mutual friend, Eddie. Yeah. Brad, you play with That's Eddie right. all the time.
We showed up with him today.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Downshift. Yeah. We'll see him later. We're doing the book launch thing for people that are going to go. You'll listen to this sometime later in the future, but okay, cool. And I'm curious, Adrian, do you think Brad will ever be able to beat you, or are you going to let him win one time? Give the old guy a chance.
You know, okay, here's one shot. I didn't come from tennis background. There's one shot that's definitely my weakness. Weakness is a two-handed backhand. And I'm working on it, but like tennis players that come, it's such an incredible shot that most pickleball players don't have. So that's his two-handed backhand is better than mine. But in terms of him beating me, I don't think it's going to happen, man. I don't think it's going to happen, bro. You're gonna die at least
bitter.
With the purpose that you like with the attempt like one day.
Exactly.
So never reaching your destination.
Yeah, there's a benefit. I won't get existentially depressed about my pickleball game because I'll always have that goal that I never achieved.
All right. We have a sponsor today, and that is Ghostbed. So thanks a lot to Ghostbed. And They have a full line of products, mattresses, a lot of cool stuff. I personally have the Lux mattress, which has some cooling technology, but I can't remember if we were recording earlier, but you're into optimizing your sleep. So I'm curious, Adrian, what's your like bedtime routine? What are some things you've figured out in the last couple of years here?
I feel like eight and a half hours is what I usually try to get. And even when I'm grinding and hustling, like promoting this book, I never sacrifice sleep. That's the one thing I always will do. Magnesium glycinate is something I have usually like 30 minutes an hour before bed. And I do like a little shot of it. Bed-wise, I use another product that has cooling technology that kind of regulates the temperature of the bed. Super important because I'm a super hot sleeper. But man, since I use using a product, any product that regulates the bed, if you don't have one in your bed, like it's like I sometimes wake up and I'm drooling. That's how deep sleep I am. It's a great, like that's just a great technology.
Yeah. And I also have additional like cooling. We'll talk later, but yeah, changed my life within 2 days. Like I thought it was expensive, but I was like, holy shit, this thing is absolutely amazing. Okay, Brad, what about you? Are you into optimizing sleep as well?
I'm into just trying to get some sleep. Okay. I've got a 7-year-old and an 11-year-old, but they're still up early at the ass crack at dawn. It's like, it's Saturday, sleep in. What are you doing? Making noise down there. I got to go check, see what's happening. But yeah, I mean, I can always tell that, you know, sleep is so important. It's so important because you actually can start to feel crazy when you don't get good sleep. So it's something that I really try to get as much of as I can.
Carl, last couple times you were on, you weren't sleeping that well. And actually, last time we recorded, we were at FinCon. So I know we don't sleep well at the conferences and stuff. So how you doing, buddy?
Yeah. Well, it's funny you ask because I got 5.5 hours of sleep last night and it sucked. The issue with me is no matter what time I go to bed, I wake up at the exact same time, which is usually like 5 a.m. And then I can't go back to sleep. So we have some visitors staying with us. They showed up late. So we were up chatting and now I'm screwed. Tonight will probably be late and tomorrow I have a concert. So yeah, the next couple days are going to be rough. Oh, man. But I'm starting to meditate. I think I need to work on calming my mind down. And Doug, you have this recommendation. You have not a pickleball, but a tickleball routine before you go to bed. Mm-hmm. And you said that really, your tickleball routine really helps you go to sleep, right?
It does. It does. It's kind of beyond the scope of this show with tickleball, but longtime listeners will know exactly what we're talking about. We'll have to explain it to you guys later, but you could play tickleball solo, if that makes sense.
I have no idea what this is.
Yeah, I don't know either. But thanks to Ghostbed, they're crazy for letting us put this stuff in the ads. Great products. Like I said, I have the Lux, and they have a 101-night at-home sleep trial. You can get 50% off with the code MILEHIFI at checkout. So thanks a lot to Ghostbed. Okay. So yeah, we'll explain that later. It's just an inside joke. It makes no sense, actually. Okay. I thought of this question when you guys were recording earlier. So your book has 21 harsh truths that help you start thinking rich, right? Mm-hmm. What is maybe one from each of you that maybe you need to flip that idea once you become rich?
All right. So this is one that Adrian and I had a little bit of a disagreement with, and it's probably worthy of exploring a little bit more. But we have a chapter in here, Go to College, Get Married, Buy a House. And really, essentially what we're doing there is speaking back to some of the like misinformation that's on the internet, and we're creators. And so we're hearing things like college isn't worth it anymore. You know, marriage is a scam. There's this whole dark side of the web where it's males talking about how women are just out to get your money. And the irony is these guys have no money. They're all broke, you know, but it's like, it's this weird thing. So I always try to be open-minded. That's a mindset of success and wealth. So it's like, oh, well, hey, maybe that's true. And so we go research. Nope. Turns out that even men have 3x the net worth when they're married. Women at 7x. So it does matter. But I think one of the things that we try to be really open-minded around is that some of those stats don't always apply. And is this really the right thing for you? And so one of the chapters is buy a house. And so Adrian runs the numbers on if you rented and invested the money instead, what you would, you know, save on phantom costs and all that, you're going to end up with higher net worth at the end of the day. And that's something that I do know some ultra wealthy individuals that decide to live that lifestyle. So they just want to rent and they don't want to get tied down to owning all this stuff. And so that is possibly a rich mindset that I think I would perhaps adapt and shift a little bit. I know that 90% of millionaires own their own homes. And so I like it. I like it because it's a forced savings. So this is to your point, like you got people who are financially independent, they have a rich mindset. You probably don't need the forced savings. If you're taking care of what you need to take care of, that rule may not apply to you. And same thing with the college. So the average college grad makes over $1 million more during their lifetime. That doesn't mean you need to go to college. As a matter of fact, you might be much wealthier by not going to college if you, for example, spend that time learning how to make money online, becoming an online entrepreneur. You're not going to learn that at college. So the devil's in the details, but I think that when you do have a rich mindset, some of these global pieces of advice don't necessarily have to fit for you, because just because that's true for most people, that doesn't have to be true for you because you've got that rich mindset.
All right. After reading every single chapter, all of these lessons apply. They are universal. They are a rich mindset. But there is one I think that could be flipped. It's chapter 12. It's only broken, insecure people flex luxury brands. And
damn, you're going to flip that one?
I am going to flip that one because in our chapter, we break down the data on how, like, most people that buy these things, they're trading their time to purchase it and they're actually broke or insecure. They need to show everyone else that they're successful. So I think it needs to be flipped, because once you have financial freedom, you're not trading time to buy something nice. If you wanted to buy Gucci something, and when, like, if I was to buy Gucci slippers, I make X amount of dollars an hour. I would just buy it because I have enough money that's paying me past my passive income for my whole lifestyle and more, and I would purchase it. So again, if I was wearing, let's say right now I was in drip chain, Gucci, everything, like, I actually am financially free. And so that wouldn't necessarily be true in the chapter where, like, everyone that wears luxury brands is broke and insecure. So I think here's the thing: when you see someone with that, it's usually a red flag. It's usually someone doesn't have financial freedom, because rich people, like, their logos are actually smaller. There's no logos at all. But I think it comes down to, rich is like what you see and wealth is what you can't see. And so if someone can be wealthy and have nice things, and you never know, are they doing it? Are they super in debt? Are they have credit card racked it up? Or is this someone who, like, actually has a lot of money in the bank that's paying them dividends? And with that dividends, everything's covered. And then they decide to buy a nice thing because they can. And you can't really tell the difference. But I think if you want, like, I hope I don't get shunned, but I have a nice car. It's a Cybertruck.
Oh, no.
Oh, you got a Cybertruck.
You have a Cybertruck.
All right, guys.
Yeah.
You do too?
No, but I went to the, like, party it? Where they – I do not have one, but I've got a Model Y, which is out front.
Okay.
There.
It's a nice car.
Okay. How do you like your Cybertruck?
I love it. It was $107,000. I paid cash. It's my business vehicle. So, like, so someone could see this and they could say, well, this guy's probably, like, he has to pay on it. He took a high interest loan. Like, right. You can't tell. So I think that's the one chapter that, like, what would actually be different. And that's, I would say 9 times out of 10, once you have, according to data, people that are flexing those things, they didn't buy it with, like, their passive income. They bought it with their active income, and they're not looking good. But they have this status thing. I didn't buy it. I bought the car because, and by the way, like, in my social media, you don't see me in my car. Like, I'm not flexing my status. Like, look at me in my Cybertruck. You won't see it. You don't see it. So it's like, they're like, that would be like me being a hypocrite. It was like, I didn't buy it for status, and then every single social media post is me in my Cybertruck, right? So yeah, I think that's the one I think about.
All right.
Do you have a rep on your Cybertruck, or is it a raw dog?
You know what? Because I'm in the fire movement, my rep quotes $8,000. I can't get behind it. Yeah. I can't give $8,000.
It's not permanent either, right? They expire after a couple of years.
Yeah, it seems like a waste of money.
Yeah.
Do you have any other Cybertruck
follow-ups? No, I have tons of questions, but I will ask them offline. I was fortunate to go to the Cybertruck release event. I think it was about a year ago in Austin, so I went to that.
Saw
the line. Yeah, it was super cool.
Wow. See, to me, that's ultimate status. You were in the room.
I just love, like, I'm a nerd. I'm an engineer. I love seeing the machines, and the machines are, like, cool. Putting the windshields on the things.
Wow.
And they're going down. Very cool. Have you all read Die with Zero?
No, but I think I got the concept.
It's kind of in the title, right? You might not have to read the book, just read the title and you've got most of it. What did you think of it, Adrian?
I like the idea of, instead of leaving an inheritance, to gift it while you're alive so you can experience the pleasure and benefit of that. I want to do that. I like gifting. I mean, the science is there, like how much more dopamine and endorphins you get from gifting and watching someone, you know, experience the gift that you gave them. Like I'm super generous with stuff like that. And I love doing it. And so I imagine I would do that, but I would rather do that than die and not be around for, you know, to leave the gifts that I want to give. That was one of my favorite concepts.
Do you think they got anything wrong in the book?
I'm going to have to think on that. It's actually been a while that I read it.
I'll jump in while you're thinking, or we can skip it also.
Yeah.
So, Brad, I would recommend checking it out, even though the punchline's somewhat in the title. There's a couple concepts that, like all books, like some of them, it's just like, that doesn't connect with me. But there's a couple that I think maybe, well, it worked for me, and I hope you may find it interesting. So one of them is time bucketing, and that is to like look at maybe like decades of your life or every 5 years or so and realize like, hey, if I'm going to travel the world, I maybe need to do that when I'm younger, when I'm able-bodied, when I can do this stuff, versus like when I'm 75, maybe I don't want to go on such long trips and be away from home. I want to be like in my cocoon at home and all that stuff. So that really, like, that got our attention, because then we mapped out like all the shit we wanted, bucket list type items, and then put it on a timeline where we're like, okay, we want to do cruises, but not for many, many years. Like the cruises are reserved for, you know, later on. Like we'll do some like more strenuous, more outdoorsy, more like physically active things when we're, you know, like right now in the next 15 years or so. So that's like one of the main things I got out of it. And there's some other stuff. There's some things where I'm like, I don't really care about that. It doesn't apply. We don't have kids, for example. So I, you know, it's great to give money to the kids when they need it, you know, thinking of usually, I won't give any specific examples, but it's like when you're 60 and your parents die in their 90s or whatever, like you don't need money any, like you kind of figured out that part. So Carl, did you have anything from, you know, Die With Zero that you really liked?
That was the most profound thing for me. Like, we have kids, they're 14 and 17, and I hope they're in such a place, as Doug just kind of inferred, that when they're 60, we've taught them well and they don't need our money. But I could probably make a huge difference in their life if I buy them a house or give them a huge down payment when they're like 30. I'll make sure they're on good financial footing. But like that kind of money at that age would be life changing. But I have no idea if Mindy and I will get an inheritance from anyone. But at that point, it'll, like, I'm so thankful to be able to say this, but it'll be a diminishing return. It's not going to change our lives at all. I don't think so, no matter how much we received. But I like what you said too, Adrian. I don't know why people like Warren Buffett, he's got like $60 billion and he's like, upon my death, it's going to go here. Like, dude, don't you want to see that money do something when you're alive? Like, I don't understand that at all. Why do you want it to do stuff? You're not, I think Bill Perkins says this, you're not actually giving it away after you die. Your heirs or your lawyers or whomever is giving it away. It's kind of a stupid concept. And just to be clear, I don't really want my name on anything, but it'd be cool to see the results of your money while you're still alive.
Mm-hmm. So you guys you're big on social media. You got a lot of followers. Like how many?
Like 1.7-ish million.
Okay. I got like 1.4. So I'm losing on that one too.
Isn't that a contest though, right?
No.
So,
but I do want to win.
You do have. Okay. So I don't like social media. I spend time on there, like scrolling, wasting some time, but I try not to do too much. How do you guys be creators, but not get fucking caught up in the weeds there and like become a consumer and get taken over? Cause like, it's horrible out there, right? So how do you balance that to like do your work but stay out of it?
I echo what you said. It is terrible for your mental health. I think it's toxic. I do two things. One, on my phone is Opal, which is a blocking app, and it blocks all social media with no breaks from 7 a.m. to 5 p.m. So that means it is totally blocked. If I have to make a concerted effort to like open up my laptop and go on social media there. So that prevents me from the habit of checking. The next thing I do is I have someone full time that is managing all communication that I receive. So I don't, sorry if you've messaged me and you heard back from me. Like I usually will, if you share a personal story, then my teammate Sydney will always say, "Hey, it's Sydney, by the way. I love what you shared," and she'll share. If you're just saying, "Hey, where can I learn more info?" or like usually it'll just come from me, but it's actually not me. So we always try to be authentic, but also like streamlined. And that prevents me from not also engaging, because like social media is so good at sucking you in. Like if I opened up my phone and I responded to a message, all of a sudden 30 minutes would vanish, because as soon as I close the message, I'm gonna see something which is gonna lead me to something, and all of a sudden time is gone. So it's like it's I think Opal is, we reached out to them a lot for sponsorship, and I'm getting ghosted right now, but like I talk about them a lot, because I think it's like you gotta block the habit of it. Dude, screen time, iPhone. How much time? Like that's such a great app. Shows where you spend your time. Here's what I learned when I did Opal. I was like, my phone's gonna be so small. And then I was still spending 2 to 3 hours a day on text messages. And then so I was like, emails, I only check it a couple times a day. I block my social media, but now when it comes to text message, I have notifications on, and I respond as I receive them. And then since I learned that of my own data, then now I have no notifications except for phone calls. And then I check my text messages. Like I haven't checked my text messages in probably like 4 hours. I'll open up and they'll probably be like 14, 15. And then I respond to it like kind of like email. So that helped me too, where now like I just am and trying to think it, but everyone has this data on your phone that says where you spend your time. And time, again, if I'm optimize for time anywhere, like the phone is a huge time suck. So it'd be hypocritical to outsource all my time from like doing yard work and chores. So then I'm just doom scrolling. That's not how I want to spend my time.
All those text messages, that seems like a lot, right? Is that like family, friends? Like you just have a big network, and like, why so many?
Dude, I don't know. Family, friends, business. I feel like pickleball. Like it's
pickleball.
It's like organizing pickleball games. it's a lot. I feel honestly, when my parents started playing pickleball, the first time, after a couple of years, I went over to their house. Like, we're just gonna have some people over. It was 30 people. I was like, you guys have more friends than I do. It's like pickleball is just tons of people. But yeah, I guess it is. I never thought it was a lot, but now yeah, that's. I guess that's why I had to. Now I don't check all the time responding. But
okay. Got it. You know, I try to be really conscious of it with my kids. So I try to actually just put my phone somewhere else, because it's, you know, my youngest was like, "Oh, Dad, you're always on your phone," and stuff like that. You're like, damn, you know, I mean, it's like, you're not even aware of it. You just get sucked in. And so Adrian actually taught me this years ago, just turning off the alerts too, saves me a lot of stuff. Cause I'll go on there to try to check my work email, and then, oh, I get an alert, and then boom, as soon as you get an alert and then you click on it, you're off to the races. And before you know it, it's a huge time distortion. You just lost 30 minutes of your life, and now you're probably pissed off about something or there's something you think you need to go buy. So yeah, it really helps to understand that these instruments are being designed by teams of psychologists. Their entire goal is to extract your most precious resource, which is your time and attention. And they're really, really good at it. So they've created all these apps, all these machines to do that. And so it helps to actually be a little bit paranoid about it, you know, and be a little bit anti that, because they're so effective and it's happening to all of us and we're really unaware of it.
Carl, do you have any tips for phone usage? Or?
Ooh, that's a tough one. I try to, for a while, I just put my phone on airplane mode, but then that backfired because Minnie would be like, "I tried texting you like 50 times." Yeah, I try to, when I come home, it never goes to the bedroom and I don't even want it on my person. So when I walk in the house, I set it down somewhere right by the front door and I just leave it. Nice. And no social media on my phone either.
I'm addicted to like Instagram Reels just a little bit. And I mean, I have it optimized pretty well for like puppies and the occasional, you know, comedian or something like that. So it's pretty good. It's not too negative. I enjoy that. But still, it's just a time waster. Or I'm in the bathroom for too long. You're like, oh man, it's been like half an hour.
My legs fell asleep. What am I doing?
So we're going to start wrapping up here. We got to do this book launch thing at the Mr. Money Mustache HQ before too long. But I'm curious about the process of writing the book. It was an interesting style where it's clear, like one of you was writing each section and that sort of thing. So how'd it go? And I'll kick it to you first, Brad.
Yeah. So it's my favorite book for many reasons. Had a great time writing it with Adrian, and you know, Adrian and I were friends. We are friends. And for this book too, it's like we connected on it. It's like, well, how do I want to spend the next 2 years? I'd love to spend it with my buddy Adrian writing a book. And so for this particular one, we came up with our harsh truths, and then we sat down and we recorded conversations about them. And then we kicked it over to an editor who put together a first, you know, essentially took our sentences and made them, you know, grammatically correct. And then we just kicked it back and forth. We probably spent maybe a solid year after that, those conversations, just tweaking it and bringing in new information and how can we bring in some research here. And then Adrian's great with his marketing background. It's like, well, we need another personal story. So actually this book, this is my ninth book. I've never really told personal stories that much. So that was a fun thing. And I like how it's discreet with the chapters. It's not like you have to read it from start to finish. It's like each chapter is a separate essay. And we really look to highlight those things. And then Adrian, I'll kick it over to Adrian to talk about how we tested this title. So we had the idea, like, these are the mindsets based on the research, based on our personal experiences. But then how do we title it? How do we title each chapter?
So we used our social media audience to test each chapter. And based off the engagement or controversy, we would lean into it and keep iterating on the chapter titles, because they're all very almost like triggering, like a hook to kind of reel you in. So some of them, for example, that we iterated many versions that were the content was the same, but how you would signal to someone like, oh my gosh, like wake up, like come over here and read this. So like one of them, like that, I think the worst one we got a lot of hate for was like, if you want to get rich, you have to get rid of your poor friends. And that first version of the title is, you're the average of the five people you surround yourself by. Right? Because it's the same concept,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that moves fast.
Yeah. I mean, that's multiple iterations. And then when we hit that one, it was like, I think in 24 hours, it was like 2,000 comments and people saying like some people were like, I know what you mean. I get this. Some people are like, you're an ass. Like, what? You have to get rid of, like, you can only be friends with rich people. That's entitlement or elitist. And like, and then it was back and forth. And the people were fighting each other. And we're like, yes.
I think we found our title.
There was some also that we like were, so this one surprised me. It was like assumptions that we have on how credit card works. Like your audience all knows this, but so one that we did not think we were going to do, we were like, we probably should have a chapter on credit. And so we did one and it was, you're not allowed to use a credit card if you can't pay off the full statement balance every month. I was like, I checked it the next day. Blew up. That's wrong. You have to leave a balance. You have to pay. You have to at least leave 30% on. Like, mm-hmm. People have these irrational strategies on why actually leaving a balance and paying the high interest rate is how you get a good credit score. We even had one person who was a CPA telling us this stuff. So it was like wild how misinformed people are on credit cards. And that ended up being a test. Because if we just went, I think ideas, if you have, we could have just sat by ourselves, like, this is a good idea, this is a good idea, but no market data of like how people think. So every single idea that's in the book was put out into the market and gauged an emotional and response. And they're like, this is something we should talk about because it triggers people or elicits people or it's people are really misinformed. So credit card was one of them that people have. How are you supposed to know how to use a credit card if your parents didn't use it right, if their parents didn't use it right? And so it's like, none of this is to judge or shame someone, just more of like, if you don't have access to the right information. So yeah, every single chapter was kind of built through data.
Interesting. I'm thinking of the Cybertruck, like you're looking for controversy with your titles. I imagine I've heard people get some weird reactions when they drive that thing around too. So I think you just like to be abused maybe. Like, is the title of the next book going to be like, fuck you? With a big middle finger on the front.
Fuck you. But
financial
we love you. Independence.
But we love you.
Just to make sure I understood. So you guys recorded conversations and then sent it to an editor, mm-hmm. to compile it and pull it together.
Yep.
Okay. And then you just edited from there.
Yeah. We came up with the titles for each one. Okay. We actually recorded it as a podcast. And then after we saw podcasts like yours, we're like, damn, this podcast sucks. But we're not going live with this podcast. We're revisiting that idea. But yeah, so we had like, okay, so here's the chapter title. Here are the 10 areas we want to cover. And so then we sat and talked about it. Because we had already outlined it all. But rather than staring at a blank cursor, so I've written my ninth book, I've written lots of different ways. The worst possible way is to be staring at a blank cursor going, okay, I need to write 400 pages.
Got it.
So okay. There are other ways to do it.
Man, all right, this is great because Carl and I have been working on a book on laziness.
Oh, cool.
And we're like 80% done. Amazing. And we're never going to fucking finish it because it's about laziness. So, and we didn't go to the like blank screen. Like we did an outline, but yeah, we may have to strategize this. Like we have hundreds of hours of us talking, so we should be able to put some kind of bullshit together, throw a cover on it.
You could outsource it to ChatGPT or Gemini or Claude.
Yeah, something like that. Okay, yeah, really, because like we could talk through the chapters and maybe like that's the way we do it. I don't know. Carl's always working on his house, so it's tough. He has that do-it-yourself-itis.
Right. Well, you guys writing a book, you could hire some help for the house when you're on the other side of that.
Yeah, maybe. Or do you guys have any skills? I know, Brad, you're local. Do you want to have skills?
Yeah, I can put a new roof on your house for you. I'm trying to not do as much of that.
Yeah. All right. So we will ask, who is the book for? Who's like the target reader out there?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think it's anyone who, first of all, is curious around, you know, how do rich people think? What's the psychology? What's the research? How do they spend their money? There's so much misinformation out there. And then I think it's for anyone who's a hustler, you know, somebody who wants to make a better life for themselves, for their family, wants financial freedom, wants to decrease financial stress. And we tried to put, you know, as much useful, actionable information in there. At the end of each chapter, we actually have challenges where we have people try to, you know, conduct some exercises, some of which I've done research on that helps improve your financial life. And so essentially, for me anyway, like on a real personal level, this is the manual I wish that somebody had given me when I was in my 20s. Like, it's like, hey, here it is. Adrian just talked about this. Like, if you don't have a family system who's wealthy, it's like, how do rich people invest? I mean, I lost a ton of money thinking that I was investing like rich people, only to find out I was speculating. But nobody taught me how to invest. And so, yeah, I think it's anyone who really wants to make a better life for themselves.
All right. Anything to add?
No, I think that's it. It's perfect. It's the hustler, the person that is curious about how you know, they maybe visualize themselves one day being rich, but also defining what rich is. Because I think that alone, everyone has... I think people's definition is different. Our definition, like which is aligned with the FIRE movement, is owning your time. So we a lot of times when we use the words like poor and rich, we're actually not talking about money. We're talking about way of thinking. Mm-hmm. So like that is a whole reset on like what you think about rich. So it's like, but all that matters is that you have the curiosity of like, I want to be rich. I like the idea of rich. And even if the illusion of rich is because you watch movies and there's it's Batman, it's like all these people like, that's great because then at least whatever it is, you want to be like Iron Man and have all this nice stuff. And then you read our book, you're like, wait a second, it's not about actually stuff, it's about time. Like the curiosity, whatever drives you. You see a nice car in the streets, a Lamborghini, great. Then you read our book, you're like, you know what? It's actually not about the Lamborghini, it's about time. But so whatever draws you in, that curiosity and then trying to help.
All right. So we'll link up so people can find it. Where should people find you guys?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having us. Our book is available wherever you get books. But if your audience was to go to startthinkingrich.com/milehighfi, we have extra bonuses and resources, which we do just as a way we can say thank you for having us on. You guys are definitely pros and we're lucky to be here.
Thanks, guys. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the show. That was the Mile High Five podcast, and I'm Doug Cunnington. If you dig the show, please do three things for us. Number one, tell a friend, a family member, an enemy about the show. We really don't care who you tell. Maybe forward them a specific show that you know that they will like. It's the single most helpful thing that you can do to spread the word. It's like giving us a virtual high five, and actually we don't give high fives in person, so the virtual kind's pretty good. And more importantly, your friend or family member or even your enemy will appreciate the fact that you were thinking of them. Number two, make sure you're following or subscribed on your podcast app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, YouTube, whatever you're using, and that way you won't miss a show. And number three, please leave us a rating and review. We read them on the show occasionally, and you might hear yours out there on an upcoming episode. Quick disclaimer, this show is not financial or legal advice. I'd actually be surprised if it sounded like it. it's really just for entertainment, and that's at least what we're hoping for. But seriously, get advice from professionals. So we'll catch y'all next week. Yesterday, I had my first colonoscopy.
Ooh.
And how old are you guys?
I'm 53.
53. Have you had a colonoscopy?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
35, not yet.
Okay. You got a few more years unless you want to get ahead of the curve. And Carl, you've had a few of these, right?
I've had like 10. I sign up for them every...
I love them.
Twice a year, yeah. I don't ask to be put under. I stay awake. It's great.
I did wake up in the middle of mine. But like, ooh, you're pretty out. It doesn't take long. Did you wake up, Rod?
I did when they were going down the throat. Hopefully, they used a different tube, but they got me on both sides. And I was like... Yeah, you need to get a lot of drugs.
Yeah. And then what about you, Carl? Did your throat get irritated?
No, my throat did not get irritated, but I woke up in the middle of mine too, and I started joking around with the doctor. I felt some pain. I'm like, hey, I think you hit my kidney or something. And then I went back to sleep.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, they go, dose them.
Yeah. More drugs.
And they warned me. They were like, hey, you might wake up, but like I'll be here and I'll reassure you. And I did wake up, and I'm like you, Carl. I started making jokes. I don't even know if I was forming words. Like, I was out of my mind, right? But I'm like looking and I'm like, what the fuck? And I'm like, can I get this video? I asked for the video and they're like, we're not recording it. And then I think I was like, I want it for my
content,
my show. But yeah, they didn't give it to me. But I'm going to follow up and see if I can get that. I mean, that's nice. It should be my content. And I don't know. Well, I'll tell you, it wasn't that bad, Adrian. So
okay.
you have several years. The hardest part, honestly, is fasting. So I fasted for about 42 hours or so.
That has to be that long.
It doesn't have to be. I think they want like at least 24 hours, but it ends up being like 36, depending on when you have your appointment and all that stuff.
Right.
Was that the hardest part for you?
Yeah. Well, I was drinking mass quantities. The hardest part for me was what was coming out the other side.
Got it. Okay. All right. And then Carl, what was the hardest part for you?
The hardest part was actually what Brad said was not the hardest part for me. I put a bidet in my house, which will save your ass literally when you have to have that, because you'll spend half your waking hours on the toilet in preparation for it. But they couldn't find my vein or artery or whatever. So they're digging in there and my normal blood pressure is usually like 120 over like 70. And I think it went down to like 90 over 40. And they're like, they started freaking out. And they're like, oh my God, what's happening? But then it all came back and it was fine. But there was some pain. The lady's digging in there trying to find it. I'm like, yeah. No bueno. Other than that, it was great, Adrian.
You'll love it.
Yeah.
You're going to love it.
Yay, can't wait.
Yeah, but, you know, people get your colon checked out. I mean, that's one you can take care of. So I know some people get afraid of it, but it's really not that bad. It's just like the preparation.
Oh, man, the drugs too. Oh, my gosh. I think I read on the chart that they had to keep dosing me. Apparently, I don't like it when people are shoving stuff up my rear end. You guys, anyway. So, but they kept giving me drugs. They kept giving me drugs. Oh, and man. So I realized, and then I later read it was fentanyl. And I got to tell you, like, kids, don't try fentanyl, because that day, it was so good. I was literally going, I will leave my wife, I will leave my kids, and I will live on the street if I can have this feeling all day, every day. Honestly, I used to be a substance use counselor. Fentanyl is the worst. Don't try it.
Damn. Well, yep, and that's when I read my outpatient stuff or whatever, same thing. I don't think they had to keep dosing me, but I didn't like it that much. I actually felt like I was not as sharp, and I didn't get the euphoric feeling that it sounds like you're
a better person.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. I don't wish I like it, but so I'm glad that it worked out. Okay.
So Doug, I'm glad yours came out okay. Like, before you went in, Doug was like, hey, I have a favor to ask, and we could do this for the podcast. There's a home colonoscopy kit on Amazon. It's like $49. Like, you could come over and administer it, and we could do a live thing. You have to have like a what are those GoPro cams or whatever that you attach to it? I'm like, Doug, I am not doing that. And you're like, come on. I'm like, no. So yeah. I'm glad that did
that's
not happen.
Really taking it to the next level.
It is.